vehicle in Deir Bala, killing 3 people. Meanwhile, an attack on a home in the Nusayrat camp killed 1 civilian and injured 8 others. In Gaza City, an Israeli airstrike killed at least 5 civilians. An earlier attack on Gaza City's Al-Falah school killed 2 people and injured 5 others. In the south, 12 bodies were recovered from a mass grave at the Al-Amal hospital in Khan Yunis. Israeli strikes killed 54 Palestinians and injured 95 others in a single day, increasing the death toll from the regime's genocide to 38,850. The International Committee of the Red Cross warns that all health facilities in southern Gaza are suffering from life-threatening injuries. It added that the Israeli massacres constantly force doctors and nurses to make very difficult choices as the medical needs of civilians far exceed the limited capabilities available. The organization added that most patients in Gaza have been displaced from their homes several times and live with limited amounts of food and drinking water in crowded areas, which makes them vulnerable to contracting diseases. In Gaza, the pain and sufferings of those survived the Israeli attacks are growing. Amongst them are the amputees, whose catastrophic situation has worsened due to the decimation of rehab facilities. Now, a young Palestinian physician in central Gaza is providing them with rehab services in displacement camps. Our correspondent, Qada Al-Zabut, has more in the story.
In the middle of this genocidal war and the ongoing Israeli attacks on the Gaza Strip, suffering is increasingly unfolding. Today we are here to present the story of Mortaz Abudayya. Mortaz led an initiative to help the people around him who are struggling with the amputations they sustained by the Israeli attacks on the Gaza Strip. The initiative of this young physiotherapist relies heavily on his volunteer efforts to rehabilitate the amputated limb for the future journey of recovery. What makes this initiative particularly impactful is the deep sense of solidarity it fosters within the community. Mortaz does not only contribute his time and skills, but also provides emotional support to the recipients who are grappling with the trauma of losing a limb in a war zone.
Actually, this initiative is about providing the service of physiotherapy. According to the current circumstances in the Gaza Strip due to this genocidal war and the lack of resources and rehabilitation and physiotherapy centers, I chose to help the injured people with amputations in my area.
In the wake of the complete absence of rehabilitation centers in the Gaza Strip by the Israeli bombing, this man is in urgent need for help. He finds his relief in Mortaz's initiative. This man is trying to cope with the unbearable conditions of life after losing his home. He's also struggling to find water, food, and medications for him and for his family.
I lost both of my legs and my arm is fractured. It is hard for me to move and meet my family's needs, so I appeal to everyone in the world to support my right to a dignified life with my family. The initiative of Dr. Mortaz is very good for the injured people, in the displacement centers particularly.
As we have just seen, this story of suffering is one of thousands. A lot of Palestinians inside these evacuation camps are still suffering and struggling. However, the suffering is multiplied when the person is amputated. This initiative led by Mortaz is trying to reach for the global community and trying to raise awareness about the circumstances of the Palestinian amputated people. Ghada Zabut, the middle area of the Gaza Strip.
An international charity organization says Israel is systematically weaponizing water against Palestinians in Gaza in total disregard for human life and international law. Oxfam says the regime is intentionally worsening humanitarian conditions in Gaza to increase civilian casualties. Oxfam's report said Israel has cut Gaza's external water supplies, destroyed its water facilities, and is deliberately preventing aid delivery to the people of Gaza. As a result, the amount of water available across the territory has been reduced by 94%. The report also suggested that Israeli attacks have destroyed 5 water and sanitation infrastructure sites in Gaza every 3 days since last October. Oxfam said water production in Gaza has fallen by 84%, with Gaza City losing nearly all of its water production capacity. Israel already stands accused of using starvation as a weapon of war by intentionally targeting agricultural lands and obstructing the entry of essential food supplies into Gaza. Meanwhile, Palestinian health officials warn that thousands of people in Gaza are at the risk of contracting polio. The alarming revelation came after polio virus was detected in samples of sewage that is starting to take over Gaza amid the ongoing Israeli onslaught. The Palestinian Health Ministry said thousands of people in crowded tents are now at risk of contracting the highly infectious disease, which causes deformities and paralysis. It added that tests carried out in coordination or cooperation with the UN Children's Agency showed the presence of poliovirus in Gaza. The ministry said sewage is flowing between the tents used by tens of thousands of displaced people across Gaza. It described the presence of poliovirus as a new health disaster. Gaza officials said this week that wastewater treatment stations have been turned off due to lack of fuel. Doctors in Gaza say scabies, chickenpox, skin rashes and lice are also spreading fast. UN agencies have frequently warned of the risk of cholera and other more serious diseases becoming epidemics in Gaza. The leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement has called on all Muslims around the world to wage an all-out war on Israel. Abdul Malik al-Houthi said the Israeli regime is pressing ahead with this genocidal war on Gaza in collusion with certain region and Western countries.
The atrocious criminality of the Israeli enemy, which we see very clearly in its ugly crimes, in the crimes of genocide against the Palestinian people, very horrific crimes, different kinds of crimes, atrocious, very atrocious crimes. They attack all Palestinian people in a very brutal way. They kill them in masses. And they also carry out different kinds of crimes when they attack them. They attack everyone, elderly, young, women, children. They kill the ill, they kill the disabled. They target those who are very elderly, incapable of moving. However, regardless, they help them.
Abdul Malik al-Houthi asserted that Yemen will continue with its anti-Israeli operations at all levels until the final victory. Houthi also hailed the Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah and the Islamic resistance in Iraq for their retaliatory strikes against the Israeli regime. The Yemeni leader slammed some hypocritical Arab regimes for betraying the Muslim world by supporting the Israeli regime. Houthi also condemned the U.S. as the real partner in all Israel's acts of savagery. He denounced the silence of international organizations as they failed miserably to press Israel to end the war. The Yemeni leader also called on the Yemeni people to come out again in a million-man march in support of Gaza on Friday. Thousands of pro-Palestinian protesters formed a human chain around the British Parliament, calling on the government to demand an immediate ceasefire in Gaza, halt arms sales to the Israeli regime, and support efforts that are aimed at holding Israel accountable at international tribunals. Saeed Pourreza has more details.
They've come out in their thousands, standing shoulder to shoulder in a line that snaked around the Parliament building as MPs sit for the first day of debate since the general election.
We've been calling for a ceasefire since October, and we're demanding a ceasefire, and it's many months down the line, and many thousands of people have been murdered.
It's the second protest since the Labour government swept to power in a general election earlier this month. An unbreakable human chain calling on Prime Minister Keir Starmer to pressure Israel to agree to a ceasefire and end its genocidal assault on Palestinians.
And for that to happen, this former Labour Party leader believes there are immediate measures the British government must take.
One, stop arms supplies to Israel. Two, demand a ceasefire. Three, stop the use of RAF Akrotiri to take material through. And four, demand the end of the occupation and abide by international law from the International Criminal Court and the International Court of Justice.
Despite his call for an immediate ceasefire, there was special fury here at new Foreign Minister David Lammy and his recent meeting with the Israeli Prime Minister.
Got the day before he went, Israel bombed Al-Mawasi refugee camp. It killed over 90 Palestinians. Now, he didn't even comment on that. Not a comment. 90 Palestinians, most of them women and children, blown to pieces. Their arms and legs scattered. around Al-Mawasi refugee camp. Why would he not publicly address that?
As of May this year, more than 70% of Britons want to see an end to the genocide in Gaza, and many back a pause in arms sales to Israel. There have been 9 months of protests demanding the UK government stop its complicity in genocide. That demand has gone unheeded so far. The question now is, how long can the new government ignore it? Saeed Purizap, London.
European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen faces intense scrutiny for her policies, including funding Ukraine amid EU financial hardships and accusations of double standards. Analysts also criticize the EU's decision to cut off Russian gas, linking it to the current cost of living crisis in the 27-nation bloc. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
Ursula von der Leyen kept her top job in the European Commission on Thursday after a vote in the European Parliament. However, she was slated by a sizable minority in the chamber, with some even claiming she should be in prison. She was accused of greenlighting genocide in Gaza and of blatant double standards by not showing the same support to Palestinians as she does to Ukrainians.
40,000 civilians slaughtered, children burned alive in their tents, and still no consequences. Colleagues, today, say no to genocide and say no to von der Leyen.
Von der Leyen was asked why she does not support peace in Ukraine after she intensified her criticism of Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban's recent visit to Moscow.
This so-called peace mission was nothing but an appeasement mission. This was a plain appeasement mission.
The European Commission wields huge power in the EU, and von der Leyen's policies of allocating billions to arm Ukraine while citizens at home face financial hardship have attracted substantial criticism. On Thursday, millions of tracker mortgage holders in the Eurozone received more bad news as the European Central Bank maintained interest rates, citing insufficient progress in reducing inflation.
Inflation is expected to fluctuate around current levels for the rest of this year, partly owing to energy-related base effects.
Those managing to stay in business say an increasing number of companies in the EU are declaring bankruptcy.
That will only accelerate as businesses that were already close to the edge will now find nowhere else to go, only bankruptcy, because there's no end in sight, really, for inflation as it stands.
The financial strain is compounded by stagnant wages and the lingering economic impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic. Families across the EU are faced with difficult choices, cutting back on necessities and dipping into savings to cover basic expenses. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Syrians have elected a new parliament, hoping that the 250-member assembly meets their aspirations. Now the newly elected parliament is facing a daunting task as the country is still reeling from years of Western-backed conflict. Our correspondent Ibrahim Wadi reports from Damascus.
After a month of electoral campaigning, 250 new members out of 1,516 eligible candidates have entered the Syrian People's Assembly to exercise their legislative authority for the next 4 years. According to the Supreme Judicial Committee, the electoral process was successful, transparent and smooth, and demonstrated true democracy in the Arab country.
The election results reflected the broadest representation of the Syrian people, with the participation of over 7 million citizens. There are 21 parties in Syria that participated through lists, in addition to independents. We have taken strict legal measures against the ballot boxes committees as soon as any complaint was received to ensure the transparency of the democratic process.
Experts say the importance of an active parliament is more prominent than ever before, as Syria enters a new phase. This requires genuine efforts to revitalize the economy, both domestically and through political engagement, in promoting rapprochement with regional countries. Regarding Turkey, Syria seeks to regain full sovereignty over its territories before restoring normal relations with Ankara.
We have seen foreign parliamentary delegations coming to support Syria before, so the new parliament must coordinate with all the Syrian allies to play an active role in lifting economic sanctions and seizing aggressive actions against the country, whether political or military. Public opinion must be mobilized internationally to remove all occupational powers from our land, whether Turkish, American, or Israeli.
The new parliament is expected to play a crucial role in rebuilding Syria and addressing the economic challenges facing the Arab country. The Syrian people are now expecting their new representatives to implement policies that will improve their living standards and create a more prosperous future. They also say they want the new parliament to play a key role in overseeing the government and ensuring accountability.
As Syrian citizens, and in light of economic sanctions that have increased our suffering, we want the new parliament members to address our concerns, contribute to finding solutions, and propose them to the executive authority in order to improve our living conditions.
The new parliament members must work together to rebuild the country after years of conflict, address economic challenges, and navigate complex regional relations. But most importantly, build a brighter future for the Syrian people. Ibrahim Wahdi, Damascus.
Well, that's it for this hour's bulletin. Take care for now.
The whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. In the limelight.
Israeli regime troops raided Shajaya under the cover of heavy strikes on June 27th. For 2 weeks, they continuously bombed the densely populated area, stormed houses, and expelled tens of thousands of people. Many families were trapped in their homes. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East irate, a Palestinian with Down syndrome, was left to die by Israeli regime troops after combat dog attack. Mohammed, who was like a one-year-old, was separated from his family after an Israeli dog mauled him. His decomposed body was found a week later. Desperate screams as he struggled to free himself from a combat dog unleashed by Israeli regime troops. The Palestinian family were hiding in their home in eastern Gaza City's Shajaya neighborhood when the Zionist regime troops stormed it, Bahr told Middle East Eye. Dogs were sent in first, which attacked Mohammed and started mauling him. The Zionist regime troops then expelled everyone from the house except for Mohammed, who was taken to a separate room. Unable to see him, Bahr could only guess his fate from the screams, as she was forced to leave the area at gunpoint. 7 agonizing days of waiting passed before Israeli regime troops finally withdrew from Shajaya. The family rushed back to the apartment. They found Mohammed's decomposing body with worms eating his face. Bahr said, "I cannot stop thinking of his screams and the image of him trying to free himself." Mohammed's Down syndrome was severe, she explained. His mental development was at the level of a baby, according to her. Muhammad was very innocent. He could not understand. He could not grasp anything. He was like a one-year-old. I used to feed him and change his diaper. I cannot bear to think of what they did to him or how they left him to die like this. The Zionist regime troops raided Shajaya under the cover of heavy airstrikes on June 27th. For 2 weeks, they continuously bombed the densely populated area, stormed houses, and expelled tens of thousands of people. Many families were trapped in their homes like Bahrs. The 71-year-old told Middle East Eye the family was besieged for a week before Israeli regime troops stormed it. There were 16 people inside, including Bahr's two sons, their wives and children. The children hid in the bathtub to take cover from the heavy Israeli regime fire. But Muhammad, who was heavy and often refused to move, was kept in the safest corner of the living room the family could find. She explained, "Before this recent displacement, we had been displaced at least 5 other times, and he wouldn't understand where we were going. Because he was obese, he would get tired and sit every few steps." When Israeli regime troops arrived, they unleashed their dog fist, which immediately jumped on Muhammad. Bahr said, "The dog bit his chest, then started biting and mauling his arm. Muhammad was screaming and trying to free himself as the blood poured. Muhammad could not speak or say any word, but out of horror, he was screaming at dogs, sometimes saying, 'Hey, you,' and sometimes, 'Enough, my dear.' I don't know how he uttered these words. We had never heard him speak before." When the Zionist regime troops entered, Bahr pleaded with them to take the dog off her son as she tried to explain that he was disabled. They eventually did, but took Muhammad to a separate room from everyone else. Bahr said, "I told the troop, 'Let Muhammad come here,' but he told me, 'No, we will treat him.'" When she heard his scream for water hours later, she asked the troop to bring him some, but the troop replied that there was a specific type of water for him. Bahr said, "I could hear Muhammad humming in pain. Now and then, they would open the door, look at him, and say, 'Stay silent,' then close it again." The troops then gestured to each other. A doctor who came with them entered the room, and Muhammad suddenly was silent. Bahr suggested that the doctor injected him with a sedative, but she could not see or hear him after that. She told Middle East Eye, "I asked the soldier, 'Where is Muhammad?' He told me, 'Muhammad is gone.' I asked again, 'Gone where?' He answered, 'He's gone. There is no Muhammad.'" The family was then forced to leave the house and head to the west of the Gaza city, leaving Muhammad behind. The family contacted the Red Cross daily for the next 7 days, pleading for Muhammad's release or medical treatment. The Red Cross kept telling them the Israeli army was not cooperating. Jibril, Muhammad's older brother, was the first to return to the house after the Zionist regime troops pulled out earlier this week. When he entered the room where Muhammad was kept, he saw it was covered with blood and fluids seeping from his body as it began to decompose. Jibril, 43, told Middle East Eye, "He was lying on his stomach. His body had decayed and worms had begun to eat his face. A tourniquet was put on his wounded left arm, probably to stop the bleeding," he added. "Based on the state of his body, it was evident he had died several days earlier." Middle East Eye obtained footage of the body but could not publish it due to its extremely graphic nature. Since the beginning of its ground invasion of Gaza, the child-killing regime of Israel has systematically used combat dogs to search buildings, including hospitals. In many cases, the dogs were allowed to attack and maul civilians. Last month, Al Jazeera released leaked footage from a camera attached to an Israeli military dog, which showed it biting and dragging an elderly Palestinian woman in her home. With hospitals in Gaza not operating and roads devastated by the Zionist regime bombardment, Jibril said he was unable to call an ambulance or transport Muhammad's body to a cemetery. It was not even possible to register his death, he told Middle East Eye. He said, I had to bury him near the house. There is about a 1 meter space between our house and my uncle's. That's where I buried Muhammad.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, how Imam Hussein alayhi salam teaches us to overcome adversity. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, an honor to be here at your service as we commemorate the martyrdom and the mission of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Imam Hussein alayhi salam, his family members, his companions, they teach us how to overcome adversities and hardships and trials are something that every single one of us face in our lives. These hardships are sometimes a natural part of life, and yet sometimes they are hardships that come about due to us living a non-pure Muhammadan Islamic life. Because we don't live an Islamic lifestyle, we come about with hardships and trials and difficulties. Imam Hussein alayhi salam, he teaches us that despite the greatest of hurdles, the greatest of obstacles, the greatest of hardships or trials, a human being can overcome, a human being can be successful, and a human being can be victorious. Of course, one needs strength in their faith. They need determination and perseverance. They need to strengthen themselves. And of course, the greatest source of strength being the Messenger of Allah and the Ahlul Bayt, peace and blessings upon them all. And furthermore, the ultimate source of strength is the Almighty God, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Why is my heart set on fire when I hear your name?
As-salamu alayk, ya Aba Abdullah.
Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So we were talking about how Imam Hussein alayhi salam teaches us to be able to overcome these hardships and these difficulties that we face in our lives. Imam Hussein alayhi salam, on the night before the 10th of Muharram, we find that him and his companions and his family members, they spent the night in the worship of Allah. They spent the night in prayers. They spent the night in du'as and supplications. They spent the night in the recitation of the Holy Quran. These are secrets for every single one of us. It is these things, the recitation of the Quran, the salah, the prayers, the du'as, the supplications. It is these things that help us to gain the strength to be able to overcome hardships and trials and adversities. It is our faith in Allah, our trust and reliance upon Allah, which help us to overcome hardships and trials. We have to be spiritually and mentally strong, that we can if we want to, and we can if Allah helps, and Allah always helps. Imam Hussein alayhi salam, he teaches us that unwavering faith and conviction help a human being to be able to overcome hardships, and unwavering faith and conviction helps a human being to sacrifice for the cause of Allah, on the path of Allah, for the greater good, for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of A to Z. Don't forget to visit our website at parsetoday.ir/EN Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah and God bless you all.
But anyone stay here won't be alive tomorrow. You can save yourself tonight and go. Silence, fill the air.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight.
Donald Trump's former doctor says Joe Biden's doctor needs to address the American people and be open and honest with regards to Joe Biden's health. We take a look at the US media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Fox News Channel has covered this story and tells us more. Representative Ronnie Jackson, Republican of Texas, who is a retired Navy officer and a former White House physician to both Presidents Barack Obama and Donald Trump, said that if Donald Trump would have shown severe neurological conditions, then Jackson would have been forced to the podium to face questions from journalists. Joe Biden's appointed physician refuses to speak on his health, Jackson tweeted on Wednesday, 10th of July. If I did that, as President Trump's doctor, there would have been immediate calls for me to resign and to impeach Donald Trump. Ronnie Jackson spoke to Fox News host Martha McCallum and said, "We can't believe what the Biden administration is saying sometimes because they use White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre as the mouthpiece to the medical reports involving the president. They either actively lie to you or they try to spin the facts and make you believe something that it is not true, Ronnie Jackson told Martha McCallum. The press secretary has been doing that for a long time now. Jackson said he thinks it's inappropriate now, with all the concerns surrounding Joe Biden's health, that Karine Jean-Pierre is trying to bring the press on Biden's condition rather than Biden's physician, who was the White House physician for Joe Biden back in 2010. This is Dr. Kevin O'Connor's job. He needs to be up there on the podium, and he needs to be the one up there briefing the American people, Ronnie Jackson emphasized. Dr. O'Connor should be the one facing the media with objective data regarding Joe Biden's health. Bring those notes, Jackson told Martha McCallum. Bring the information that was generated to the podium and show the American people that there's nothing wrong with the president and he doesn't have a cognitive issue if that's the case. The American newspaper, The New York Post, has also covered the same story. President Biden likely suffers from a cognitive disease and should not only drop out of the presidential race, but resign immediately, according to the former White House physician and current Republican congressman who served former Presidents Barack Obama and Donald Trump. The former White House physician and current Republican congressman Ronnie Jackson said this is a national security issue. He told the New York Post after Joe Biden's disastrous debate performance, he said, as an American, I think he needs to step down and he needs to be immediately removed from office. Before entering politics, Ronnie Jackson served as Barack Obama's personal physician between 2013 and 2016. He also served as Donald Trump's personal physician between 2016 and 2018. Donald Trump raised Jackson's name during the televised CNN debate when the issue of their respective cognitive functions was discussed. Jackson, a former U.S. Navy Rear Admiral, said Biden's confused and halting performance during the televised debate was clear evidence he's suffering from more than just normal aging. There is a condition, I don't know what it is, I'm not going to give him a diagnosis. It is more than just age, it is some type of cognitive disease, Jackson said. I don't know if it's Parkinson's disease or Alzheimer's. I don't know what it is. There are a lot of diseases out there when folks get older which can cause cognitive decline. Ronnie Jackson previously called on Joe Biden to take a cognitive test, something that Biden has not done as president. You aren't going to hear me talk about cognitive tests anymore. He's got one on Thursday night in front of millions of viewers and he failed miserably, Jackson told the New York Post. Ronnie Jackson said if Joe Biden does not leave his own accord, his cabinet secretaries should consider invoking the 25th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which allows the president to be removed from office if they deem him unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office and replaced by the vice president. Joe Biden and Donald Trump, at ages 81 and 78 respectively, are the two oldest candidates running for president, and the issue of their mental capacities have dominated news headlines for months and was a central question during the CNN televised debate. I took two tests, cognitive tests. I aced them, both of them, as you know. We made them public. Biden took none. I'd like to see him take one, Donald Trump said, whilst Biden looked on with bemused expression. Ronnie Jackson said he never identified any cognitive issues with Donald Trump. Anybody can sit down and talk to Donald Trump for hours on end. He's very sharp and he's an incredible memory. There has been no change whatsoever in his cognitive abilities since I have known him, Ronnie Jackson said. Joe Biden would be 86 years old at the end of a potential second term in office. Biden's shaky debate performance promoted a wave of new questions from close allies about whether he should continue to seek re-election. Team Biden has vowed to stay in the race and has already insisted he will go ahead with September's planned ABC-sponsored televised debate with Donald Trump. Sky News has also covered the same story and tells us more. Donald Trump says he expects Joe Biden to remain in the presidential race for the White House because he's got an ego and he doesn't want to quit the race. President Biden has shown no symptoms of Parkinson's disease, his doctor has explained in a letter released after reports claim a specialist has visited the president several times during the past year. Concerns around President Biden's health have risen since Biden's poor showing in his televised debate with Donald Trump. Democrats described his performance in the televised debate as an unmitigated disaster, a meltdown, and a slow-motion car crash. According to the New York Times, White House visitors log shows that Dr. Kevin Kanad, a neurologist who specializes in movement disorders and recently published a paper on Parkinson's disease, visited the White House at least 8 times from last summer through to the spring of this year. However, Joe Biden's personal doctor, Kevin O'Connor, released a letter that insisted President Biden has not seen a neurologist outside of his annual physical exams. The results of this year's exam were detailed in my 28th of February letter. An extremely detailed neurological exam was again reassuring in that there were no findings which would be consistent with any cerebellar or other central neurological disorders such as stroke, multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's disease, etc.
Lecture on the life of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam by Sheikh Muhammad Baig.
Hasbunallah wa ni'mal wakeel. نعم المولى ونعم النصير أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين سيدنا ومولانا أبي القاسم محمد وعلى آله الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين أما بعد The fourth Imam, he is known as Zainul Abidin, the ornament of the worshippers, Sayyidu Sajidin, the chief of all those who make sajda. Sajjad, the one who makes excessive sajdas, and Zul Sakanat. These are the alqab, the titles of Imam. his birth, there's controversy regarding the birth, and which is obviously regarding every imam. We see that there are different dates that have been mentioned. Two dates are mentioned for the fourth imam, the 15th of Jamadil Ula and the 5th of Shaban. And obviously these differences are because of the severe political situation where the companions of the imams were not able to give the news of the imams to the rest of the believers. And because of that, we see the differences are there in the narrations that have come down to us in regards to the birth of the imams or the shahadat of the imams. But when we see this imam, we will see that this imam is the only imam whose mother is Persian. The only imam whose mother is Persian. The mother of our imam was by the name of Shahrbano alayha salam. And she was the daughter of the king of Iran by the name of Yazdegerd the Third, or Yazdegerd the Third. It is said regarding her in our history and in our riwayat that when she was a princess, she had a dream, and Hazrat Fatima alayhi salam visit her in a dream. And she had given Islam to her and explained Islam to her. Now obviously, you know, who else can describe Islam better than Hazrat Fatima? And to her, it wasn't any doubt in her own words that she had said that she had accepted the truth when it came, and she saw it very clearly. And as she accepted the truth and became a Muslim and submitted to Allah, then she had another dream in which the Prophet of Allah came and he introduced Imam Hussein and proposed marriage for Imam Hussein to her. She accepted the marriage, and it is said that the Prophet recited their akd in her dream. This was the akd that was recited by the Prophet, and hence it was told to her that soon the Muslim army would conquer your father's kingdom, and you will be brought as a slave to Medina. And it was told to her, do not worry, because no one will touch you until you reach my son Hussein. And it so happened that when she came as a slave, it was in calmness. Usually when you are taken as a slave and captured, you are worried, you are frantic, you don't know what's going to happen to you, where you're going to end up. But the people who brought her there, they saw that in her there was a calmness as if she was so sure where she's going to go and that nothing is going to happen to her. And when she came to the market, to the slave market, it was Imam, it is said that a companion of Imam Ali alayhi salam, salawat alhamdulillah, who was appointed by Imam Ali al-Islam in his khilafat to rule over the eastern provinces, saw them and he took them and brought them to Imam Ali, her and her sister. Both of them came there. And Shahrbano, or her other name being Shahizanan, she was given to Imam Hussein. She was asked, who would you like to marry? Imam Ali asked both of them, who would you like to marry? And she replied in return, I would like to marry someone who has no one else above him. And that's why Imam Ali said, such a person is only my son Hussein. Go and you can be his wife. He was married to Hussein, and the other sister who came with her, she became the wife of Muhammad ibn Abu Bakr. The other, the one who Imam Ali always regarded as a son. And as she became the wife, Imam Ali, he told Imam Hussein that take special care of her because she's going to be the mother of the best of all the worshippers. And this is something over here, I want to stop a bit over here just to make us understand you see, everything that Imams say, we should not just let it pass by without any reflection on it. It needs to be understood what their wisdom is and what they want to teach us in regards to that. Obviously, Imam Hussein knows the ilm al-ghayb that Imam Ali has, and it wasn't for Imam Hussein that Imam Ali is trying to say this, that you take care of her and be kind to her and look after her because she's going to be the mother of the best of worshippers. It was a lesson for all of mankind that in order for us to have children that are great, it is very important that how Imam Ali advises Imam Hussein to take care of her, be kind to her, raise her up in respect and honor so that when she will have children, they will be honorable children. In other words, if we want to have honorable children, then we need to give honor to the mothers before they have the children. Before the mother has the children, give them honor, give them respect, so that when they have children, those children will also be honorable and respectable and dignified. If we try to put down the mother all the time, if you say things about the mother or try to make her look or belittle her, the children that she will produce also will become dishonorable, just the way that you treated the mother. This is why it's so important. Imam Ali is advising Imam Hussein that look after the wife, make sure that your wife is held up in honor and respected, because you want a woman who feels respected, who is dignified, to have children, because those children will be dignified also. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala. And hence we see that the fact that a Muslim, that before Imam Hussein was introduced, when we see her testimony, Shahrbano's testimony in regards to the dreams that she had of Bibi Fatima and the Prophet, we see that before Imam Hussein was introduced to her, we see that it was Bibi Fatima who came and introduced Islam to her first. So that she submits to Allah, that she understands from her depth of her soul that this is the truth, and she submits to the soul, to that truth that is in Islam. We have a riwayat, in our ziyarat, we give testimony to this. I read Ziyarat-e-Waritha the other day. Now I'll just read another ziyarat, which has the same meaning that Allah is implying in this. For those, the lineage through which Imamat came down, all the Imams, they came down. When you look at the lineage, it is said, we are giving testimony that the wombs and the loins through which your light has come. We're speaking to Ahlul Bayt and saying, O Ahlul Bayt, we are giving testimony that the wombs and the loins through which your genes have come and your lineage has come, Allah has never, it has never passed the eyes of Allah, and that Allah was looking after those wombs and looking after those loins in order to make sure that your light remains purified, and every generation before you of your father and grandfather going up, you can make sure that Allah has made sure that your light has been purified. And hence, if any mother of the Imam has come, it was first that she was purified before she became the mother of the Imam. This is what we believe in through our ideology and through the ziyarat that we have, that we testify to. And hence, when we look at Imam, just I want to go through the titles of the Imam, a few, and inshallah, you know, say something regarding the akhlaq and the method of the Imam in his life that he led, so that it becomes clear for us and we can take some lessons from it. If you send me a loud salawat. The first title we will discuss is the fact that Imam was given this title, Sayyidu Sajideen. Or Sajjad. These are titles that Imam was given. Now, why was he called this? What was the reason behind this?
Sheikh Muhammad Baik.
I praise Allah for sending me you, my love. You found your home, it's here with me, and I'm here with you. Now let me let you know. You've opened my heart. I was always thinking that love was wrong, but everything was changed when you came along.
Imam Muhammad Baqir alayhi salatu wa salam. He says that my father, meaning Imam Sajjad, my father, whenever he used to think of Allah's blessings, he would fall into sajda. Whenever Allah used to protect him from the enemies, he used to fall in sajda. Whenever Allah used to give him trials, he used to fall in sajda. Whenever Allah used to give him a tawfiq, he would fall into sajda. And he would fall into extended sajda. In other words, obviously to us as mustahab, even after we pray, we make sajda shukr. But when we get trials also, do we fall into sajda and say, thank you for this trial? When we get hardship from Allah, do we fall into trial? Whenever the Imam used to get hardship, he used to fall in sajda. And it became such that the greatest of all trial, because our ulama and our historians and even the riwayat that we see that we have, it has been mentioned there also that the Imam who faced the greatest trials in his life, if you look at the history of all the Imams, it is Imam Zainul Abidin. Imam Hussein's trial was just in the first 10 days of Muharram. In fact, the last 3 days of Muharram, when the water was cut out, then you see the trials began. Imam Hussein knew what he was going to face. In 3 days, those trials ended. Imam became shaheed and he went towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. But it was from that point onward that we see Imam Sajjad took the reins of the tragedy and went through all the places of ignominy, through Kufa and Sham, and through the hardships that they went through. It was Imam Zainul Abidin who faced that. Imam Hussein had seen Karbala. Imam Sajjad had also seen Karbala. But you see, when Imam Sajjad was asked, where is the greatest trial you face? He said, Asham, Asham, Asham. In other words, the trials of Karbala truly began after Karbala. The hardship began after that. And when that trial was given to Imam Sajjad, I want you to see this, my friends. Just see what Imam Sajjad is going to. When this trial was given, when was it given? When he was given the imamate. As soon, where did his imamate start? No other imam started his imamate in such a precarious situation. No imam started in such a precarious situation. Imagine this. All the imams, they began their imamate. Yes, their father was shaheed. But you see that shahadat was just him. That grief is there. But the fact that the Ahlul Bayt, the family of the Prophet, is just killed and only remains the woman, and you are the only man.